pretty important bills. Senator Higgins was here before, and we strongly suggested that you go out and kind of work things out a little bit, and I hear pretty good things so far, but we'll let you explain what you've done and see if we can move this bill forward.
Okay.
Senator Higgins.
I have a delete all amendment.
Okay.
And then I have a couple oral amendments to it, a couple of technical things. On the first line, we have to move to amend Senate file number 443 rather than the House file. This was drafted by the reviser, so that was a mistake that I didn't catch. And then on line 4.16, delete confirmed through the, on line 4.17, automated pawn system by the originating agency, and insert the word made. So it would be the investigative hold must be made within 72 hours, da-da-da. So if somebody would offer that for me, I'd like that.
Senator Scoy will make that amendment to the amendment. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Now, do you want this amendment offered now to get it?
Yes, please.
Senator Scoy will move the A or the 0483 amendment as amended. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Higgins.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, the last couple of times I've been in here talking to you about this bill, I have tried to get the scrap dealers to go into the automated pawn system. This amendment backs away from that, and instead it would require the scrap metal dealers to be part of a Department of Public Safety, BCA, interactive crime alert network. And this is the same network you might know that does the Amber Alerts. There are about 8,000 businesses in Minnesota that are signed up to get alerts from the police departments and sheriff's departments and other law enforcement agencies throughout the state. And what this bill then would require is that the scrapyards be sign up and become part of this system. And I have here with me Janelle Rasmussen from the BCA, and she's going to show you how easy this is to use, and so that you have some comfort when you're talking to the folks out in your districts about this new way of doing things. And I'll turn it over to her at this point.
Yep. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Chairman Metz and members of the committee, my name is Janelle Rasmussen. I'm with the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and we coordinate the Minnesota Crime Alert Network. I'll quickly do a walkthrough of both ends of the system. The first end is how scrap metal dealers would sign up for the network. We currently have in the network 52 different business categories, one of them including law enforcement and other media. But local law enforcement agencies are trained throughout the state of Minnesota by the BCA to utilize the Minnesota Crime Alert Network to notify businesses of crimes that have occurred and to request their assistance in solving these crimes. We have, as Senator Higgins said, over 8,000 businesses in the state of Minnesota that voluntarily sign up for the network and, in fact, even pay $12 a year to get these alerts. And every law enforcement agency in the state is sending alerts, and 1,400 investigators in the state are trained to do so. The first end of the demonstration is how a business would sign up for the Minnesota Crime Alert Network. The web-based system, which we're about to go online with in the next 20 days or so, is demonstrated right here. The information from the scrap metal dealer, they would just simply fill in this information, click proceed, at which point they would be welcomed and be able to choose which categories they would like to sign up for. For scrap metal dealers, it would be the specific category just for them as they have signed up for before. Scrap metal dealers, they select that category and they go down to the bottom, choose whether they would like to receive alerts from the state by email or fax. Hit submit and they're signed up for the Minnesota Crime Alert Network. It's that simple. We house all of their information in our databases at the BCA. All the information is confidential, and we update it once a year by contacting the agency when we do billing through our finance department. The other end of the Crime Alert Network web-based system is for the local law enforcement agencies that would be sending alerts to scrap metal dealers or any other business in the state. They simply go online, choose that they're going to be sending a crime alert message. They can do this from the office or have dispatchers send these alerts for them from the office, or they may also do this from their squad cars. If they have access to the internet, they can upload a form, download a form, whatever they'd like to do. In this case, we have a crime alert that's created, and so we're going to upload the copper theft that we're going to be sending out. Simply select it. We have the capability to choose whether this is an updated alert or a canceled alert as well. So as soon as they have solved the case, they can send out their cancellation. They put in a synopsis, whether they want in their front end of the message to say this is a copper theft alert, we're looking for a suspect in St. Paul, whatever they want to add in this section, the investigator would put that in. They choose here whether or not they want the alert to go statewide, by region, or by county. And this information can get very specific when we're sending out alerts or the local agencies are sending them. We don't want to be inundating the businesses with alerts that don't affect them. We want them only to get the alerts that would affect them. So we choose in this section right here where we would like the alert to go. We can choose by region is what we normally do. And if we want to go in the metro area, we just select G. And then you choose where you want the alert to go as far as business categories. And businesses are allowed to sign up for as many as they'd like. If they're a scrap metal dealer, but they also have a parking lot and they want to get alerts about that or any other issue, they can sign up as well. The investigator just select the category, where in the state the alert's going. Hit next, and it comes up next with a brief summary of the alert, what they're about to send. They can change that information. It automatically gives their contact information, tells them where it's going. They hit send, and within 60 seconds, 1 minute, the entire state that they've selected is notified on the alert. We use a broadcasting system, so it goes out immediately utilizing thousands of phone lines. So every scrap metal dealer or law enforcement agency or any other business in the state that they wanted to get this alert will be sent to them within that time frame. They also, at that time, the investigators can download a list of everybody who just received this alert. So we sent this to all Metro scrap metal dealers. Now is when a list would pop up saying, these are the scrap metal dealers who got the alert. This is how they got it, whether they got it by fax, email, and this is the exact time that it arrived at their business. So they have that information if they're doing an investigation and looking for where that alert may have went and what time it was received in case anybody had bought any stolen items. And that's the system.
You know, I look at that thing up there, and I thought you were giving us an eye exam. The type is about 4-point type. Yeah.
And Mr. Chair, it is easy for them in their alert to also put in photos. In the case of the little statues in Theodore Worth Park that were stolen, they could have put photos in there. You can see that just in that little amount of time Janelle's put in photos to go along in that. So that's the system, and I think that there shouldn't be any anxiety about this system as there was with the APS system. And I only learned about this when I called over to get some information about the fiscal note, and the nice gentleman at the BCA whose name was on the bottom of the fiscal note said, hey, I have something you should know about. Yeah. And then we got connected up, and Janelle and Superintendent O'Malley came over and gave us a rundown on how this would work. So if you have any questions about this system while Ms. Rasmussen is here, then I'll go through the bill.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Higgins or Ms. Rasmussen, what triggers the report at the scrap metal dealer that he would do his part here? And I get the police officer sending the report out that they would see the pictures and stuff that stolen stuff was there, but I think you said that the scrap metal dealer would be able to put something on the website. What triggers that?
Mr. Chair, if the scrap metal dealer sees something coming in that is suspicious looking, they would contact their law enforcement agency who would then send out the alert, you know, to other law enforcement agencies. You know, here's something that looks suspicious. Is anybody hearing about anything? I've asked Ms. Rasmussen if there is a point at which the scrapyards could actually put the alerts out themselves, and she's going to work on that. It well, isn't the capability right now. Right now it would be talking to the law enforcement.
Okay.
Senator Bonner. Sorry, were you done, Senator?
Yes, sir.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Janet, I was wondering if you could just say a little bit about the electronic process of putting the photos on your form.
Ma'am.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff, it's basically a Word document. You click on the box where you'd like to insert a photo, and you upload that photo into the box. It's very simple. We've designed it so that it's very easy for people to use. Right now we're using the fax system, so investigators throughout the state are basically faxing in something, and sometimes that can be difficult. So we wanted this to be very easy, and they'll be able to just walk right through the system and do it.
Mr. Chair, I would like to follow up with you at another time because we're looking at how to use a similar technology to attach driver's license photos on a form, and we've really been roadblocked at how that might be possible, and it sounds like you have a pretty good handle on that.
Yes, we do.
Thank you.
And Senator Bonoff, I should talk to you about that, too, because we did some work in judiciary the other night that will help you out on that.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Higgins, thank you. I heard.
Okay.
Senator Higgins, this is sounds like a good step, but do you still, with this alert, do you still need the video cameras and all of the equipment and looking, you know, getting the pictures of the people and of their cars? Because, I mean, this will alert people also what's going on out there, I hope. But do you need that next step? And Senator Sparks and I talked about that a little bit earlier. Then I see it's a felony, too. So do you still need that? Is that been agreed upon?
Mr. Chair, yeah, I think we
still need that.
Still do need that.
Cameras and
I think many of the larger scrapyards, for sure, already have a video system. You know, they're already videoing all the vehicles that come in or, you know, somewhere in their yard, maybe at the scale or someplace. They are already videoing. We put the option in here that they can have a video system or they can take digital photos. You know, some of the smaller places, you know, somebody may have a digital camera, but they maybe haven't put the money together for a video yet. So it's an option, either or. They can, that's
this,
up to
this
them.
Area isn't a felony. It's another section of the law that I was looking at. So this is a gross misdemeanor. Okay, I'm all right on that. But I just didn't know about the small little companies with the price of the equipment and that, but with this BCA stuff.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Bach.
And I talked with Senator Higgins about this earlier. I'm still struggling with the video cameras myself. You know, we got a lot of small little dealers around the state, and we're asking them to, I mean, it's not only the cost of purchase, it's the cost of operation, and it just seems like another burden on real small people.
Yeah, that's I think I was coming from Senator Bach also.
Maybe if there was some kind of threshold or something, some volume you had to do before you had to have it, but Senator Higgins, I'm still kind of struggling with that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bach, in here, the video camera is not required. They can use a digital still point-and-shoot camera if they want instead of the video camera. I think what they'll end up doing is they'll realize that, you know, the video camera at some point will be something they would like to upgrade to once they get to it. And, you know, maybe the scrap dealers who are small, who don't have a lot of volume,
won't feel
that need to go to the video system. I've put in here an option, a video or still.
Senator Bach.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, I think you're going to make people feel pretty uncomfortable when individuals come to somebody's business and they're required to go out and take a picture of their vehicle. I think, you know, in a whole lot of small communities, I think that's it just doesn't seem very consumer friendly to people that are coming to frequent your business that you got to go out and take a picture of the license plate or whatever it is we're trying to capture.
Let me just, my personal feelings too. I mean, I think we can assume that 97%, 98% or 99% of these people are legitimate, and it's the bad actors we want to get. But at the same time, every time you come in and stand here, click, 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 and then go to their car, and I don't know, I like you, I just think you're g- guilty before you're... But anyway, we'll keep visiting and talking.
Senator Metzen, the video camera would be less invasive.
Yeah, I know that, but...
It would be wall-mounted, and then there wouldn't be that standing while I take your picture.
Senator Bach is kind of saying, the costs of that for the smaller people, so they can't do it, so they'll get the little guy and click you. And, but anyway,
And I don't know if there are any law enforcement people here who want to talk about
the use
of that. I actually haven't looked who's sitting behind me, so... if there's a law enforcement person here, it doesn't look like anybody's jumping up. So, but if you let us get this started this way, I'd sure appreciate it. We do have the option in it. I understand that some people probably just can't go out and buy a video system, so they don't have to. But I think they'll find that they want to upgrade to it at some point, and that's up to them.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, I don't find it, but didn't the original bill have some threshold amount of scrap in it? I don't see it, so maybe it didn't. Maybe I just had a dream about this bill or something. Heaven forbid.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, this is a delete all, and what the sections that we are, I guess it looks like all new language. Well, no, not quite. We went back to the original scrap metal dealer statute, and then now we're amending that. So there are a lot of things that were in the original bill that aren't in this one. So that might have been there.
Did you have a threshold on the first bill?
Chairman, of amount of
amount
value
of business
of product. I thought there was.
To do what? I'm sorry.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, that if you had less than a certain dollar amount.
Oh, then you were exempted out of this.
I thought.
Yeah. No, that's gone.
Okay.
That's gone. Well, there is, however, existing language on...
this is the first bill?
Starting at 2.22, existing language saying that they're not required to furnish or keep any records of property purchased from merchants, manufacturers, or wholesale dealers, those who have an established place of business, or any goods purchased at open sale from a bankrupt stock, bill of sale, that's all existing language. And we're not changing that.
Mr. Chairman...
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I support Senator Higgins' bill. I think that feel uncomfortable, but I hope that it makes the thieves feel uncomfortable. I mean, that's be a deterrent from doing what's happening. I mean, what's happening now is egregious, and our police shouldn't be having to. I mean, they need some help with enforcing this, so I strongly support this.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things, I think I agree with Senator Bach in that what we're trying to do is the scrap yards that are out in greater Minnesota anyway, we're trying to get people to actually recycle things or take things out of their backyard, clean the area up, get them over to the scrap yard guy. And so now, they load the trunk up and they go over there and they're going to get a picture of the person. And they're going to take a picture of his car. I don't know. I mean, I think it makes people nervous. I not that they're doing anything illegal or anything. They're just kind of wondering, now, wait a minute. You know, I'm just trying to get $18 out of my backyard with all this stuff that's here. I want to clean it up, get it over here, pick up $18 and drive away. And the guy says, oh, okay, well, you stand here. I'm going to take a picture of you that and everything. I don't know.
They put any numbers below the...
My case, probably, but normal people...
SD, number. Mr. Chair, Senator Day, I think if they know that the reason that it's being done is to stop the bad actors, the people who are coming in who have stolen things and somebody's laying out a bunch of cash to them, I think they'll understand. If they know that their stuff came from their backyard, it's theirs, they have the right to do whatever they want to do with it, but that these measures will keep the bad guys away, I think they'll be okay with that.
Well, there's a need for some. I had a friend called Thursday, and they had $4,000 worth of copper, brand new, taken from their backyard. And somebody probably sold it, but that's a case where that should show up because you know darn well it's not used stuff. It's not, just, but anyway. there's a need for something here,
that,
but I
that this will help.
I don't know if that video thing still. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I mean, you've got the date and the time of the place, the name and address of the person selling, their driver's license number. What are they? What do you need the picture for? You've got all this identification of them that you can go and find them if you, if the showing that the material has been stolen. What purpose does adding a picture to all of this other information do? Because the goal, I would assume, is to find the person that stole the stuff and sold it, so you've got their driver's license number and their address. And what do we need a picture for?
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, as your seatmate right next to you said at the last hearing, you know, there are instances when somebody comes in with a driver's license and it's clearly not that person. And so
that should trigger that, then. Something.
Yeah.
That should trigger the BCA thing if it's the wrong.
It should trigger
phase.
The BCA thing, yes. And part of the language that we added, the new language, talking about the being connected up to the BCA system. I can't even find right now. Says that the scrap metal dealers must register with pay a little annual fee and actively participate in this system. So it, you know, we don't want them to just say, you know, send it to this computer that we turn on every week or two. We want them to actively participate in it. And as Senator Metzen said, that goes both ways.
When
something comes in that looks like it's clearly suspicious, the conversation has to go back to the law enforcement, and that's what we're doing with this. And I think it's, I, you know, it's not invasive as the, you know, people thought the pawn system was, and so I think this is a good step.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Well, yeah, I support this. This looks like a really good compromise you've got here, and I think all of that's fine, but I don't see what purpose the picture does for this. You've got their name and their address and their driver's license number and, like, you know, license plate of their car. It seems like that ought to be enough.
And if you're a foreigner, you have to have a document that includes the applicant's photograph, full name, birth date, so you've got...
Mr. Chair?
And then below, sub 6 is a license plate. So Senator.
Mr. Chair, I have Sergeant Paul Ford here from the St. Paul Police Department. He's been working with us on this, and listen to what he has to say about this, please.
Okay. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and thank you. I understand your concerns about the photograph and how it might make the good people be uncomfortable. However, the issue that we're dealing with is that criminals have fake IDs. They are we did a search warrant at a house yesterday. They're making fake IDs on a copy machine on the Lower East Side and stealing identities. So if they're going to steal copper out of houses as repeatedly, they can just as easily make these fake IDs and have the fake IDs and go get their copper that they steal recycled. The photograph will help because if they have a fake ID and it's a bad picture or whatever, then we'll have something to look at and say, oh, here's our bad guy. I know this guy, but this ID that he gave the scrap dealers, this is fake. The other issue is that Senator Higgins has worked really hard on this to come to a compromise. I know there was a lot of resistance from the industry regarding this bill, and she's really come back quite a bit. She's done a lot to find ways to compromise. And our other concern in law enforcement is the scrap dealers are not asked to take an ID. I mean, that's a fact, and we can prove that. We've believed it all along. We had one of our investigators take some scrap to a scrap dealer over in St. Paul. It was videotaped by Channel 5 News. They had it on the air, and it was on the internet for a while. The investigator who sits next to me brought the copper pipe. We cut it and packaged it similarly to the way thieves do. He brought it into the scrap yard, and they asked for ID. He said, I don't have an ID. And the guy's like, well, I don't know if we should take it or not. And then they weren't going to take it without the ID. And then finally the investigator said to the scrap guy, well, how about if you give me 50 cents on the dollar for it, still with no ID? They took it. So this adds a little more accountability onto the scrap dealers because just like there's bad guys out there, there might be some unscrupulous, not the owners of the businesses, but maybe just the guy they hire from the temp agency who's taking it in. That's why the video or the photograph is very important. It's imperative to this. It'll assist us in prosecution as well.
Senator Rosen.
These creeps.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would agree that Senator Higgins has worked very hard on this bill. And I guess, Senator Higgins, I'm wondering if there's well, first of all, I think we should I'm glad you came and testified, Sergeant, because I think that's very important to hear what you need, the tools that you need to enforce this. But I'm also hearing from around the table that there is an issue between basically the scrapyard dealers in greater Minnesota and perhaps what's going on in the Twin Cities. And I'm wondering if perhaps we can entertain something that Senator Scheid said about a threshold that would address these smaller scrap dealers that are they aren't seeing this magnitude of a problem out in greater Minnesota. I don't know if we've addressed the issue like that.
How about, let me piggyback on that. What if are the big ones, they're just big ones, aren't they in the cities, whatever big ones mean? What if it was just a metro bill to begin with for some of this ID stuff? And outstate, they're smaller, most of them. Well, they know the people, don't they? You know, would that make any sense, or is that watering
it down?
Mr. Chair,
all they'll do is just go, you know, another
they'd go
10
somewhere
miles
else,
down
and then they'd probably leave the cities and go.
Sure.
All right. Well, I'm always a person of trying to compromise.
That's right.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bach.
Chairman, I learned long ago it takes a motion to do business. So I'd like to move on page 3, delete subdivision 4, which is lines 3.0 to 3.33.
Okay, state the page 3, what is it again?
Subdivision, oh. Subdivision 4, which is lines 3.20 to 3.33.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I just think that if you adopt this amendment, you really hamstring the police. And, you know, it's a crisis out there. And I'm sorry, but I really suggest that you don't do this.
Further discussion on all those in favor of the Bach motion to delete subdivision 4 on page 3, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Finish. Division?
Division. All those in favor, raise your hands. Opposed? The motion does prevail. Yeah, I know you're not real happy with that, but we could pass this bill and go a year and see how this reporting works out. You know, it's a good start, I think, Senator. But we need help. And Senator Carlson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I have a question if there's another hole in this here. In some cases, 1-800 got junk. Somebody brings a truckload in that has some stolen articles on it and some that are not stolen. Is there some way that this can capture the correct records there? Or else, and you know, lo and behold, there might be some scrap dealers, like what the officer said, may be on living on the ragged edge. If they go out and pick up junk, and go out and pick up stolen scrap metal. Is there some way that this will also capture that record?
Yeah, maybe the gal from the BCA.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, what we currently do with cases like that is they would report that to their local law enforcement agency, and then that local agency would send out an alert as well. So that alert would still go out to everybody requesting, you know, where that information may have been or where that stolen property may have been taken from.
But
if they did take
that stuff off, Mr. Chair and guest, I'm not sure if I'm Carlson. Understanding that clearly. I'm talking about if, for instance, the scrap metal dealer would go out and pick up a load, and that load that they would pick up, or you know, they'd have an employee that maybe has a different idea and takes half the value of it. They pick it up and bring it in to the scrapyard. And there wouldn't be any record of who actually sold it and brought it in. Is there some way that can be captured, too? Because what we don't want to do is set up another industry of people going out and picking up stolen property.
Senator Carlson, I hadn't thought about that, but we have to make a stop in judiciary, so I'll see if I can figure out something in between here and there.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Bonnef, or excuse me, Senator Rosen first.
I was going to move the bill, but I'm sorry.
Okay. Oh, Senator Bonnef.
Yeah. Mr. President, I have an additional amendment.
Okay. State your...
I was wondering if Senator Higgins might consider a friendly amendment to be reinserting the language of subdivision 4 with an insert saying for 7-county metro area and regional centers. And I don't know how we would define the regional centers, but I'm thinking it might not just be a metro issue. We might have issues in St. Cloud and issues, you know, places where there's a lot of business and industrial areas. So I'm wondering, as a starting point, and then if it works, then maybe next
year. Expand it later. That's kind of where I was going. Plus, if there's shenanigans going on, you still have to do this part of it,
mm-hmm.
right, in the rural areas. So if you know, somebody out there gets a...
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Bonnef, so you would reinstate the video camera thing just for the seven...
For the seven-county metro area.
Way to define, a big one in Duluth or Mankato.
Right, if I could ask council for some help with regard to how you'd state the regional center language.
Mr. Chairman, there is no common language for that.
Well,
common language for the metropolitan county.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, we could create some new language. That's easy. Senator,
Mr. Chair, I think there might be some language with regard to regional centers in the property tax articles because they receive a regional center aid.
Oh, excellent.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, thank you. If we could, and maybe we could leave that part of the language open for Senator Higgins to add an amendment at the next stop, and so know that that's the intent of where it's going.
Well, I'd like to do it here. If
okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, that was there until the Senate decided to revert back to a previous aid provision in 2003. So it's probably not there anymore.
Did you have somebody downstairs?
Well, maybe, Mr. Chair, we can say regional centers, and then we can go find that language.
That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to do the metro and regional centers. And there's a definition of that. Can we figure that definition out the next 37 minutes or 82 minutes or something? Are you...
It's called a metropolitan state. Mr. Chair? Mr. Cassidy suggests the metropolitan statistical area, which includes the what we think of as the regional centers.
Is that language work?
Mr. Fuller can talk about that. I think that's a, I mean, if we can figure that out, I think that's a good
I think that'd be a good start. And then if it's serious out in the rural areas in a couple of years, we go back at it. But the stories I hear about, and I hear a lot of stories around, maybe because I read the papers locally, but that's where I see the main activity.
Yeah, most of the metropolitan yards
are already
big ones, and they probably already do video.
Yeah.
So I move that amendment as stated.
In concept.
Everybody real clear on the amendment?
No.
I think we want to see it. Are you...
Mr. Chair, do you want us to step aside and you can hear another bill while you get
Why don't we do that?
Back?
That's good. You're...
Good.
Our metro folks are getting
They like photos, photo cops, photo this, photo that.
Senator Marty?
To him, I don't care.
Are you in the building? Are you in the room? Oh, both.
Photo cops.
Senator Marty, we're dealing with amusement rides regulation provisions. Senate File 1370. Senator Marty, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate File 1370 is a step up from our very minimal regulation of amusement rides in Minnesota. In the early 90s, we had legislation that largely required rides to have insurance and to be inspected by the insurance company. This bill tightens up on it in a number of ways, and the bill is partly prompted by there were several incidents in the last few years. One of them that made the news heavily was one up in Hinckley where there was apparently an operator error and safety latches were not properly latched and two young women fell out and I believe both of them are doing fairly well right now, which was good news because it was kind of frightening at the time. But this bill, Senate File 1370, was initiated by the Department of Labor and Industry, and I've worked on this, the one who authored the original bill 10, 15 years ago, and so on, been working with the department, and the department's been working with the industry some on this, and I have two amendments I'd like to offer as authors, have somebody offer as author's amendments to put the bill in the shape I'd like. And I'd like to incorporate, if Mr. Fuller is back, and what, delay the effective date, but I'll wait.
What are the numbers of the?
They're A2 and A3.
Okay. Senator Sparks will move the A2 to get this one in the shape. Are the A2 and A3, is that correct?
That's correct.
Sparks will move that. Any discussion? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And Senator Bach will move the A3 to get it in the shape the author would like. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Marty.
And, Mr. Chairman, I also would like to have a delayed effective date till January 1st of 2008. The bill is silent on it, so it would be August 1st. But that's the middle of the amusement ride season, and rather than try and start up in the middle, I think it'd be smarter to wait till the end of the season. So January 1st of 2008 is the proposal, and Mr. Fuller's not here, but I would prefer I can wait till he gets back for that.
Why don't we wait on that? I don't see the effective date yet.
Okay, yeah, there is none, so we would just.
Oh, you don't have any at all. Okay. Okay, why don't you we'll wait on that for a minute. Go through the bill.
I have Mr. John Schultz from the Department of Labor and Industry here to help as well and answer questions and so on. And I'll explain the bill as it's been amended now. Sections 1, 2, 3, so on, are simply definitional sections. 1, 2, 3, 4. On the one I'll point out is of notice is the amusement ride operator, a certified amusement ride operator means somebody who's been certified by, these are two national organizations, NARSO, which is an National Amusement Ride Inspection Group, or AIMS, which is amusement industry, I believe manufacturing trade association. Anyway, that they'd have to be certified by one of those two groups. Section 5, we're changing existing law where it requires the insurance on one of these rides has to be not less than $1 million per occurrence, and we're changing it to $1 million per person, but total of $2 million per occurrence, so we're basically doubling that. In Section 6, we're changing the annual inspections, which are right now done by, the insurance company, would be that the amusement ride would be inspected at least once by certified amusement ride operator, who could either be an employee of the insurance company for the ride or an independent inspection service. Again, if they're independent, they'd have to have $1 million liability insurance, which is similar to what we require for electrical inspectors and others in Minnesota. They'd be required to inspect the rides annually. If there are flaws in it that does not meet the national standards, page 4, line 11, if they don't meet the standards, they must notify the operator of the owner of the defects. Those defects would have to be fixed and the ride reinspected before they could operate it. Later in Section 6 on page 5, we require daily inspections by the ride operator, just current with the ASTM standards, again, they'd have to be recorded in a daily logbook that they were inspected, but again, that'd be done on-site by the person who's operating the ride. Section 7 would require them to maintain an incident logbook for all rider injuries. I think they have to keep it for 3 years, but it also would require them to report to the commissioner to law enforcement any injury or accident that results in death or hospital admission level seriousness. Section 8, we're requiring the owner of amusement rides to cooperate with the Commissioner of Labor and Industry and provide whatever information Department of Labor and Industry needs to make sure it's operating correctly. Section 6, Section 9, we're taking out the commissioner going to the county attorney for offering injunctions. We are allowing the commissioner in the amendment under Section 12 the authority to order a cease and desist order if they believe the ride is unsafe to operate. Sections 10 through 13 are deleted by the amendment, and Section 14 is repealed. Back to the amendment, there are a couple other things I'd point out. Section 6, the top of the A2 amendment, we will require an amusement ride operator to be at least 16 years of age. We would also require that the owner have a documented training policy. They would determine what's appropriate training. They would be required to train their operators. Again, the incident in Hinckley was an operator error. The person may have been trained. We don't know, but this would simply be they have to record. They have to have a written policy for what machine is, and some are obviously much more complicated than others, but that'd be up to the owner's determination. They just have to make sure they train their employees appropriately. The line 11 of the amendment would require reinspection if they alter it or modify it. This language is changed a little more to reflect some concerns. Valley Fair thought the original language we were talking about was unclear, so this was adopted to change that. Also, if there was a serious injury, they would have to have it inspected after the serious injury, which, again, was an injury that requires at least hospitalization. And Subdivision 5 of that amendment would require they must make it available to law enforcement or the commissioner upon request. And Section 11 would be that the operator would be clarifying what I think is probably the reality now, but it would clarify that the operator can remove somebody from the ride if they're violating safety rules, which are up to the amusement park to determine what the rules are, but that they have clear authority to enforce their rules. Section 12, there again, would be that the commissioner has the right to order cease and desist if they believe a ride is unsafe. The A3 amendment was simply putting in some suggested changes from the State Fair Board. They wanted to allow that in some cases they apparently, on behalf of the carnival rides there, they would handle the paperwork and they'd handle the requirements there, and so that would authorize the state fair to do it on behalf of the rides at the state fair. And I'd be happy to stand for questions. I also have John Schultz from Department of Labor and Industry, as I mentioned, who would be happy to speak or answer questions, and several other witnesses. I believe you should have somewhere in your packet a letter from the League of Cities, a letter of support for the legislation, and Joel Carlson, the trial lawyers, is willing to speak to it but does not feel a pressing need to, and I believe there may be others who wish to testify as well.
Did you wish to say a few words as long as you can, or you think we're doing all right? We probably got the votes already? Or?
Mr. Chairman, I think you're just doing fine. If you have any questions, I'll try to answer them for you.
Well, I just think that I'm not the big rules and regs guy or for more government kind of a guy, but I think in this whole area we need some help, and there's too many incidents out there that have been going on, and I think Senator Marty is to be complimented for bringing this forward. I think you've done this before, but maybe we could have saved some injuries and a couple of lives had we done this earlier, but that's my editorial for the day. But Senator Dave?
Mr. Chairman, and I don't have any problem with the bill, but one of them here was the person 16 years of age. Senator Marty, how old has it been? Or is that new?
Mr. Chairman, there was no age limit now.
Oh, okay.
That was somewhat arbitrarily picked. Okay. I have not heard people raise concern about it. I think most operators are at least 16. I don't know that they're all 18, but it was just an arbitrary determination we thought might be reasonable.
We're going to work on that date thing, and then I think we can get the date and move the bill on. The committee wish for anybody else to speak on this, or okay, I think all we're waiting for is the effective date. Senator Marty, could you repeat the date that you're looking for? He wants to add an effective date. There's no date on there now.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senate Counsel, I was wondering about having an effective date of January 1st of 2008, because the way it is now, it's silent on it, so wondered if you could.
Are we talking about the entire bill?
The entire bill.
That makes sense, since some of the stuff is on a calendar year basis. And so give them time to bring it in. That's, I think 08 would be appropriate. It's possible, practical.
That's what I'd like to suggest then, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I'd offer that.
Okay. Senator Scheid will offer that date, I think we, and where it fits in appropriately. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Any further discussion on the bill? Anybody in the audience wish to speak against this Senate File 1370?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, and I apologize because I stepped out, and I just wondered, I'm not sure if the word's practicable, but I think it is. How practicable is it to, it looks like things have to be inspected. Oh, here, I'm looking at the scrap dealers. Inspected on a daily basis when they're in use. Did you cover that or talk about that?
Section 12.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty. Daily inspection is actually performed by the ride operator itself. It's separate and different from the annual inspection, which is performed by a certified inspector.
Okay.
Did we take out the remedies there in Section 12 or in an earlier amendment?
Yes.
I guess I've been told we do. The reason I'm asking that, the Judiciary Committee wanted this bill.
Chairman, we did take out Sections 10 through 13 and replace it with some things in the A2 amendments. But there was no judiciary issue that I think left in it.
That's what I'm of the opinion that if we pass it out of here, it moves right to the floor.
Yeah.
So we have a interesting.
Senator Day, did you have a?
Mr. Chairman, no, but there was an individual when you said, is there any opposition?
Oh yeah. I'm sorry. Yes, move up to the. Thank you, Senator Day. Sir, identify yourself and.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my name is John Magel. I own Magel's Carnival Midways, and I'm the operator that had the incident up in Hinckley. And as far as there not being any objections, there's objections to certain parts of this by my insurance carrier and people involved. My incident didn't arise from poor inspections. It arose from operator error. I'd like to know how, when I have my inspection before I open in the season, how my insurance carrier and loss control people are going to be able to visually see how my rides are being operated and by whom. It's just their general practice. They want to see everything in operation with people on it, make sure that the loading procedures are going properly. And they can't do that by inspecting us in the spring. That's the same reason that the electrical inspection, we do our initial in the spring before we open, but they come out each time, each week, to re-inspect us. And
as that's the insurance companies that do that.
Yeah. But as far as $1 million thing for the inspectors to carry, that's going to limit our numbers of inspectors. And I'm a state truck inspector. If I had to have $1 million policy to inspect trucks, I wouldn't be inspecting them. It's just another burden on inspectors to come out and do a good job. So. That's all I have to say, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Sir, did you wish to comment?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, The concerns of the department related to the annual inspection are that the department believed it's important that the inspections occur prior to operation in Minnesota rather than after the attractions or the carnival may leave Minnesota. And there's even a question then is if they are even inspected in that year, if there's no requirement for inspection prior to operation. So the department believes this is an important issue. It doesn't require the inspections to actually be performed in Minnesota. They need to be performed in the same calendar year by certified inspectors, but they could occur in any other state, which is, for many of the carnival operators, is very typical. They start their carnival season well in advance of actually showing in Minnesota because of the seasonal, typical season in Minnesota. Regarding the liability insurance, those inspectors who are employees of insurance companies are not required to have the liability insurance. It's only those that are independent contractors that are required by this provision to have the liability insurance. The concern the department has is really on behalf of the citizens of the state. It believes that not requiring that independent inspector to have insurance creates a buffer between the insurance company and the citizen of the state. And it believes it's necessary to have that liability insurance. I understand that the rates for that liability insurance may be significantly higher than they are for other classes. But as an example, it was mentioned that electrical inspectors, of which there are about 90 plus that are under contract to the Department of Labor and Industry to make electrical inspections, they're required to have $1 million of errors and omissions insurance and also $1 million of commercial liability insurance as part of the condition of their contract. So it's not unheard of. It's also a requirement of inspectors, of amusement ride inspectors of other states. When the department looked at amending this 184B, it did look at laws in other states, made an attempt to really just strengthen 184B reasonably and not provide provisions that would be onerous to the industry.
Let me ask you, some of these traveling amusement companies, if they're in another state, are some of them probably covered under NARSO or Ames in some other state?
That's right.
Now, and what happens? They come here, they're already got the certification because they were down in Missouri or something, right?
Mr. Chairman, wrong. That's right. They would be.
So we're not requiring a second test. And what do you think? Half of them that are in operation around the state might be covered already or that come into our state? Or I know there's a lot of local ones like the gentleman.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know exactly.
How many would be?
How many rides it would be? I mean, because there's a. I think that becomes an issue as to how many rides it actually is, not necessarily how many operators, because we've. Some of the large operators are the ones that come open in other states for the season, are playing. They might even be operating today in other states, and they'll come into Minnesota typically beginning in April and May and June.
But some might be certified already.
That's exactly right.
That's the point of trying. All right, any further questions? Anybody on the committee like the bill? Want to move the bill? Sir, I'm sorry. Do you want to speak?
If I could, real quickly. Sure. My name is Randy Forsier. I'm with Gopher State Expositions. We are a carnival, traveling carnival based out of St. Cloud, Minnesota. And I am here as well. We probably don't know that there is several carnival companies that are based out of Minnesota, and we happily call this our home. As I got three other carnival companies behind me, as well as a couple that couldn't make it here today. We were here last week to try to hear this bill, and we're postponed till today, of course. And as part of a quality ride operator in the state of Minnesota and a resident of the state of Minnesota, we highly feel comfortable with most of the writings of this bill. Again, as John Mega was saying also, is that there is a need for certain inspections inspections are going on now. There is very few accidents in the state of Minnesota on traveling carnivals. And, of course, when something does happen, that is why it gets very much blown out in the media, because it is a very rare event. But nonetheless, I do highly suggest a bill to make sure that everything is inspected. The only, again, issue that we have complications with is just the calendar year. And I understand, to the point that they're making also, that they want to see it after it's maybe come out of storage or want to make sure that it's taken inspected before, say, a Minnesota patron comes on it. But again, the idea just that if it could be at a later date, like, I don't know if I could pull out like a July date or something like that. I'm just requesting that it's not a January 1st till January 1st. I do, again, say that every year, a year inspection is good. Just, I don't want it. I don't like to see it fall under that January.
I don't know if we're hung up that much on the dates, but you're not objecting to the certified amusement ride inspector by NARSO or Ames.
I really don't have much problem with the
that's the one I would
thing
think
at
people
all.
Would be
no.
But, okay, you're not objecting no. to that. You're, something about the date, Senator Marty. I don't know what could be.
Mr. Chairman,
if it would help their industry. I don't know what.
What we were trying to do is make sure it's sometime in the calendar year before they start operating in Minnesota. So if they start operating here in April, we want to have them be inspected sometime before April. They could do it any time in the calendar year. If they're only here during the state fair, they could do it in July or whenever. But the point is, once a year prior to the beginning opening up.
I think he's trying to liberalize it a little bit more and make it easier for you. I think it's where you could do it any time during the year. So I don't think it's going to hurt you, in my opinion. Correct?
It's just being January 1st till, or say the calendar year like that, what it does for us is, There are some out there that are operating like right now, and they can get their inspections done and come to the state and have no issues with anything. An operator like myself, which starts up at some of the small festivals, I have West St. Paul right here, and the property only allows me the size of the property only allows me to put up 10 pieces of equipment there, and then maybe the following one I can put 12 up, and then the next one allows me to put 20 up. And it's just the complications of rounding up the inspectors to do that week to week to week until everything is done. It does provide a very big complication for our industry. And if it is, you know, say yearly without that.
I'm going to have to constantly explain that date thing
okay.
a little bit.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm sorry I missed some of it, so I may be wrong, but when we said January 1, that's the effective date
right.
for the bill. You understand that?
I do understand that.
Then the annual inspection doesn't have to run that annual. It doesn't have to be a calendar year, or we can make
that,
it explicit.
That's just the way that I read it.
You right don't want here. It to run on a
calendar year basis.
Because you would be inspected once every year under any system.
Correct.
You know, so not understanding the concern, because it could be July in that annual.
Well, right.
Or but to the next July.
What they were proposing.
Okay.
What they're proposing here in this bill is that it is inspected and has that certification prior to the very first opening day in Minnesota. And for some of us local operators here, again, we'll start up in May, and that'll be our first event in May in Minnesota, which is a very complicated issue. And like you're saying, is that as long as it's done once a year, you just said it yourself that it's going to be inspected each year, whether it's in July of each year or if it's in January of each year. So if there can be like a fiscal year set on it of like an easily time would be July 1st to July 1st instead of the calendar year January 1 to January 1. That is really the only thing we have an issue with on this bill as a carnival industry. Just makes it.
I'll try it again.
Did I not answer it? I'm sorry if I did.
Oh, no. Mr. Chairman.
Now's the time to get it cleared up.
This is basically for the author. I think Senator Marty's intent is to have you inspected before you operate in Minnesota. So that could constrain it. I mean, if you started operating in May, it's my understanding he wants you inspected in Minnesota before May. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Fuller, the language in the bill doesn't require the inspection to be performed in Minnesota, but the language in the bill requires it the inspection to be completed before operation in Minnesota. All right. Now, that creates, understandably, that creates some stress for those operations that
Minnesota companies.
But, well, not necessarily only Minnesota companies. There are Minnesota companies that are, I think, that are probably in operation today in other states.
All right.
Because they have a base here in Minnesota, they don't necessarily not operate through the rest of the year in other states. The problem that we see is that I think it's a real problem trying to balance this. On one hand, we have carnival operators that don't operate through the entire year or outside of Minnesota prior to opening in Minnesota. It's difficult for them, especially if they open in a fragmented manner where they have just a portion of their rides at one location and then the next stop they have more. But then we've got other carnival operators that may only come into the state and stop once, twice, three times. They're from out of state. They jump into Minnesota and jump out again. When do they get their inspection, or do they ever get their inspection? That's a concern that we have regarding some of those operators. When do they provide that, or when was it last inspected? And those are concerns that we have, and it's difficult to balance it between those operators and some of the local operators that don't operate in that same scale.
I
don't
think so.
Are you responding to that? I think you're okay. And by plus, if all else fails, we could resort back to this tape we have that our intent. I think we're Senator Marty. I don't know how
Chairman,
we get out of this.
I'll talk with the industry.
You want to visit with them for
and see if there's a way we can come up with a date that works. But I understand their concern if they have 10 rides open up at one place to get them all inspected,
yeah,
and then
true.
They have a few more later. I mean, several visits. So I'm certainly open. The main concern we had was that they're inspected at least once a year. We prefer it to be before they open up, but I'm open to talking with them.
And the operators have agreed the inspection is all right. So, well, what do you need? Just you need some time now for the next 10, 15 minutes?
Chairman,
I'd like to process this today. And
he's interested in having a chance to talk with them for a couple of days before. Should we?
We have time.
I mean, I'm willing to commit to talking to them before we get to the floor.
All right, why don't we temporarily lay this over and let's work it out and then come back in a few days. I think there's no money or anything in here, so we've got some time in the policy. All right, is that agreeable with the operators?
Yes, that sounds good.
Yeah, I don't think Senator Marty's out to the so-called get.
I don't. No, I don't either. Like I said, the bill is very, very fair. It is.
Our kids particularly, and that's where he's headed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, Senator Higgins, do you have your thing hopefully worked out?
I think we do, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff asked me to offer this, and I do so willingly and supportively. It would be to reinstate subdivision 4. I'm sorry, on page 3 of the, let me make sure I'm looking at the right thing, of the Delete Everything Amendment. Page 3, reinstate Section 4, and at the end of it, I don't know if it would be C, probably parent C. This section applies to scrap metal dealers in the 7-county metro or metropolitan area and cities having at least 30,000 population, a population of 30,000. At least a pop.
And
Senator Higgins can help me do the grammar.
Moorhead, Mankato, St. Cloud, Rochester, and Duluth. And I think those are the regional centers. We could go to 20,000, but that gets us down to you know, smaller cities like Austin and Faribault.
Well,
and
let's,
I think 30,000 is the right number. So,
committee members, you have Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have some reservations about this, Senator Scheid, and that's because I don't know that we want to have two tiers. I mean, I kind of think that there should be some uniformity. Now, all of a sudden, we're going to have, you know, depending on where you're operating, you're going to be governed by this set of rules, and if you're somewhere else, you're going to have this set of rules, and if you're, you know, a criminal, you can pick and choose now. You can say, well, if I go here, I don't get photographed, I won't have a video camera, and I just think it should be one standard for everybody, and so I'm not real keen on the amendment. I understand what Senator Bonhoff was trying to do to offer some compromise and such, but I just think it needs to be uniform across the state.
Well,
okay, I don't know. I think Scheid and Bonhoff come up with a good compromise, and you still keep going back to that thing. If there's some big problems out there, even the little ones, we'll have to do this. So, but any further discussion on the Scheid amendment?
Oh.
Pardon?
We just fix it up later.
Oh, we're going to fix it and do it now.
Mr. Chairman, I can give
all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Oh, chairs in doubt. All in favor of the Scheid Bonhoff amendment signify by saying aye. Okay. Opposed? Okay. Not adopted? Not adopted. Now what do we do?
Do you not vote? This is to put
the committee. So we move the bill with the section taken out. Yep.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd move the bill.
Well, we need something. I agree with that.
The bill as amended.
Okay.
Does it need to go someplace?
Judiciary.
On the amendment, on the bill. All those in favor, as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
No, these other ones might get a little hairy, though.
I need to go down. Senator Bergman's trying to come to our Maple Grove Hospital. Right.
We sent somebody to get Senator Berglund. I think Senator Carlson, yours could take a little time. Or
but these are bad guys. And it's blowing up houses.
Think she's going to be coming, or who knows?
Sometimes you can't snap crack.
Pro business.
Yeah. I told them we got to put some pit bulls in where the copper is, and then they wouldn't be stealing it. Right?
Yeah.
A couple pit bulls in there, I'd do it.
A couple machine guns.
Houses.
Pilot's outfit.
What are we doing here?
Murphy's is Catherine's.
What are we doing here?
So save the kids. Burglar.
Push green.
The font for it.
Let's go into judiciary. I'm sure the police will also.
That was a tough committee, isn't it?
Carlson.
Yeah.
Good going.
That's a little more than you.
I have an amendment. I can fix it up.
Sometimes they don't believe you and they fix them up. It's an add-on.
Should fix them. Should fix them before they send them off.
You fixed that last one pretty good. We'll give her about another minute. She was supposed to be on the way. Now, can you guys read that screen from where you're at, or is that the test I talked about from the... I know I'm getting a little older than most of you, but
real clear from here.
Well, if you could read that, you
Superman
could be a space cadet. Skoyke, you could probably see it. You're 20 feet closer.
I can see that it's white.
It's white and the blue. I can see the BCA at the top.
Yeah, I got that too.
Bald eagle couldn't beat that.
He's going to have to go the other way. All right, Senator Murphy, we're going to hear your bill.
Next on our agenda is Senate File 1806, Senator Murphy, Electricians' Extra Unemployment Benefits.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, Senate File 1806 is a bill that was brought to me by the union I belong to, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Union. And as soon as Mr. McConnell gets his laptop up and running, he's got a slideshow, a real quick slideshow that he wants to kind of walk through to kind of show you where we're at as far as electricians go within our labor organization and why we feel that this unemployment insurance is should be extended to these members who have who are out of work. And if you're ready to go, Dan, take her over.
Thank you, Mr. Connell, for being here today. And if you just introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dan McConnell. I represent electricians in Minneapolis for International Brotherhood of Electricians Local 292. And I'm here today on behalf of all the locals in Minnesota. And I'd like to thank God on behalf of all electricians in the state. There's approximately 10,000 of us that are licensed in the state. And I've got a little presentation that I'm going to go through here that explains how we feel Minsky has adversely affected our industry, and I think it pretty much speaks for itself. To start out, you can see that in 2002 there was a downturn in the construction industry, and that electricians, along with all the other crafts, were affected by that downturn. And if you compare the statistics that we receive from MNSCU, you can see that electricians are being trained at a rate that is 319% higher than any other trade in the state. If you look at unemployment statistics from the Department of Employment and Economic Development, you'll show that 15.9% of carpenters and 16.4% of plumbers filed claims for unemployment during the last 3 years. If you look at the same numbers for electricians, you'll see that number is 27%. And if you look at the number of electricians that have exhausted those benefits during those 3 years, that's 27%. The electricians who filed claims have exhausted their benefits. That means they've gone beyond the 26-week time limit for the claim. Here's a spreadsheet that I got from the Department of Economic Development that lists the potential claims and the average weeks paid. You can see that the weeks paid for electricians is significantly higher. And you can see that the dollars paid was $47 million for electricians, which is double, and only $42 million for carpenters, which has about double the amount of people employed in that trade. And we have comparable numbers to plumbers, and they're at $24 million. So you can see there's the disparity there. You can see that the average exhausted in the last column for electricians is about 25.1%. See here that MNSCU offers 67 instructional programs in the construction trades, and they graduated nearly 6,000 during the five-year period from 2000 to 2004. Of those 6,000 graduates, 47% of the graduates were in electrical construction programs, while electricians account for only 9% of the total employment in the construction trades. Here's just a little graph table showing the number of electricians produced by the system. If you compare Minnesota to the other states in the nation, you can see that Minnesota ranked number one 4 out of the last 5 years compared to the other states, and number one overall in the number of electricians, 464% higher than any other than the average. And that's the numbers to back that claim up. And then if you take the ranking, the number of graduates compared to the number of people employed in the trade, you'll see that we rank number one 3 out of 5 years compared to all other states, and that they're training in a five-year period, they train 25% of the current existing industry.
Madam Chair.
And that's...
Excuse me. Senator Michelle has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McConnell?
Yes, Senator.
Madam Chair, and maybe Senator Murphy, too. I had you at the first bullet, which was economic downturn, 9/11, 2002. I got that.
Okay.
And now as I'm looking through your presentation, I think it's the first time that I've heard that our public institutions of higher education are actually hurting an industry. Is that the point you're trying to make here, that Minsky, which we spend millions of dollars on, literally in this very room, right, Senator Tomasoni, is hurting your particular industry?
Yep. Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, yes.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Michelle, what's going on is Minsky continues to pump out a lot of electricians. And don't get us wrong, we appreciate having more and more people in the trade. Unfortunately, there's not enough work to go around for the existing electricians. And what happens is we're spending a lot of money training these people, and they end up most of the time not working here for their full career. What happens is they get hired on normally at those lower-scale jobs that are mainly non-union. They get a little bit of experience, and then they move along. And most of the time they go to sunshine states where there's more ongoing construction and more work to be done. So the money that we're investing in these people, they're turning around and taking it to Colorado, California, places like that. And, you know, not only are we losing those experienced workers, but when you have basically a glut of electricians, you have more and more people sitting on what we call the bench. They're not doing anything. And that's not good, because then you have people from outside the state come along and they pluck our best employees and they take them some other place. And we don't like that. We'd like for Minsky to slow down what they're doing, maybe start training some other trades. The Carpenters Union could use a few extra folks. Plumbers could. Pipe fitters could. But, you know, we have a glut of electricians. And because this has been going on and on and on for years now, we've got a lot of experienced journeyman electricians who've been in the craft for a long time that are now finding themselves sitting on the bench and they can't find work. That's why we want the extension of the unemployment benefits. It's not only that you know, and we don't only feel that it was the downturn of the economy. That affected everybody. You can talk to Senator Bach. He had people sitting on the bench too. But it picked up a little bit. He's got fewer people sitting around not doing anything, but we still have a glut. And I believe it's because of this training that has happened. You know, it's good training and everything, but we've got too many. And the state basically has let this go on. And now we've got people that are sitting on the bench. They don't have jobs. They don't have work. And we want to keep them here. And if we could just pay them some unemployment benefits for, you know, a few more weeks. And I still every time that I see this on page 2 in subdivision 5, where it says applicant up to 26 times a weekly extra unemployment benefits amount, I always have to go and run and ask Mr. Fuller how many weeks that is. So hopefully he was listening and he can tell me how many weeks that is. But we're just asking for a little bit of compensation, because it's not only the downturn of the economy that hurt us. It was also having so many people trained and not enough work to go around.
Well, and Madam Chair, just to follow up.
Senator Michelle.
Senator Murphy, have you had this discussion with Minsky? You know, it strikes me we should be on the front end of this issue and not the tail end with all the UI benefits.
Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, yes, we have met with Minsky. We met with the Vice Chancellor's office last week, and they've issued a directive to all their campuses that they will not add any more programs, and that they will set their enrollment targets below the current targets for the next year. But this has been an ongoing problem since the early 90s that we've had this problem with Minsky. It's gotten to the point now where it's become a crisis for our people in their unemployment. And we're simply asking that we grant them a little extra unemployment at this time to carry them through until we think the work is going to pick up.
And a question from Senator Bach.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Murphy and the electricians, I think, raise a pretty important issue that the Higher Ed Committee's got to take a look at. I mean, higher educational institutions need to have programs that fit the needs of the workplace. So, you know, these Minsky institutions are in our communities around the state, and workforce needs are different in different places. And Minsky needs to have more flexibility to respond to the needs of local employers. I know when LTV Steel went down, there was a real strong need for training for the individuals who were displaced out of the mine. 1,400 people lost their jobs. And Minsky, in the campuses along the range, did a very good job of developing some customized training programs. And one of the areas that they did create a program for at the Eveleth campus of Minsky was masonry for people that lay brick and block and stone-type work. There wasn't a program like that, but there was clearly a need for some craftspeople in that area. So I do think Senator Murphy and the electricians bring up a good point. And I guess it's our job to be the oversight to make sure that the training that we all are appropriating money to do here, that there's a need for those individuals out in the workforce, because there's no point in giving an individual a skill set that they can't take out and get a job with. So I do think we can do a better job, and thank you, for Senator Murphy, for bringing this issue in front of us. And I think the Higher Ed Committee has to spend some time on it, because, you know, we spend a lot of money at this. And at the end of when they get their diploma, we like to think that they're ready for employment somewhere, and we don't want to send them to the unemployment line when they get completed in their training.
A good point. Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chairman, Senator Bach, you're right. I think that, I was on the Higher Education Committee for about 8 years. And during that time, we carried the committee went through a process of reducing mandates, especially, in the Minsky system. We tried to get rid of a lot of these mandates so that, our technical schools and our community colleges, the ones that are closest to where we're producing workers, so that they'd have more flexibility to do things like that. Unfortunately, what's happened, in my opinion, and I think that the facts probably bear it out, is a lot of those mandates that we ripped out of statute, and it started off at 1,000 and it went south of that somewhat, but we ripped out hundreds of mandates on these institutions, and now they've crept back in. And I don't believe that Minsky still has fully realized their potential as far as being able to deliver a product that business owners need. I don't think that businesses are well served by putting more and more electricians out there when they need accountants or laborers or steam fitter welders. And also I think that the IBEW and the electricians, even the ones that aren't represented, I think that we make a valid point here that because of some of the money we spend in higher education, it's caused our industry, our workers, havoc. And we're just asking for a little fair shake here.
Are there other questions? Is there additional testimony?
Well, I could just add, Madam Chair, that as the discussion was going on, you know, even within our trade, if you're a certified welder, you can go to work tomorrow. I mean, there's a huge shortage of that, and Minsky isn't training as many welders as there are electricians. And as the union versus non-union, that's not really an issue. I mean, we had a higher unemployment when in 2002 when we had the downturn in the commercial industry because that's where we have a greater market share. Recently, we've seen the downturn in the residential, which is now leveling the playing field for us.
So how do we change the problem? Because we're talking about how to fix something, but what would be something that could be done to really get the message across to Minsky? Because we've had testimony in the same room from the Nurses Association in that all the overtime that is needed because we don't have enough nurses. And this, again, is a training issue, and how do we address that issue? I'm not sure we'll have that solution today, but it feels that there's a message that needs to come from this community, you know, on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's correct. And our discussions with Minsky, we've touched on that briefly, and we look forward to working with them on finding that solution.
Okay. Is there anyone who wants to speak in favor of the bill? In opposition to the bill? Yes, please come forward. Lee, yeah. And Mr. Nelson, if you would introduce yourself, and also David Diedrichs from the Minnesota Chamber is here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I am the Director of Legal Affairs for the Unemployment Insurance Program in Minnesota. There's a few things I would like to point out specifically as to the testimony given, and then I would like to point out as to this bill itself and the problems which this bill has. The first thing I'd like to indicate that the department's position regarding extensions has always been why a particular group. I do want to point out when the statistics given here today talked about a 25% exhaustion rate for electricians, that's actually below average for all applicants for benefits. Actually, last year, about 30% of all applicants who filed exhausted benefits. So, in fact, electricians exhaust benefits less. They are less likely to exhaust than are the average applicant. In the week ending March 3rd, 871 people who are applying for benefits exhausted. In the first 2 months of the year, over 8,189 people exhausted their benefit entitlement. So exhausting, like I say, electricians actually exhaust less than does the average person applying for benefits. So those are some of the things we have regarding fundamental fairness regarding an extension for a particular group. Electricians don't appear to be unemployed longer than the average person who applies for benefits, in fact, less. Now, this particular bill has a number of problems. One, it has a residency requirement. That would appear to me be strictly in violation of federal law, which is one particular problem. This bill, I also want to point out, charges the employer the extension. Some of the past extensions have not done so, meaning that employer who employed this electrician will pick up the tab through a higher experience rating for this. So that particular employer will be responsible. Another particular problem is who's an electrician. I heard the testimony before. They were talking about licensed electricians, journeyman electricians. That isn't who's covered by this bill. This bill is anyone who applies for unemployment benefits who lists their work as an electrician. And we simply, that's a broad-based category. That doesn't mean you're licensed. That means you did some sort of electrical work, and you, if you're filing online, happen to check that box. It doesn't mean that we don't go through a broad description, do you fit these particular descriptions? We simply ask you broad categories, and we drill down, and you check a box, electrician. Or this would be an electrician installer, I believe, of the code or the broad-based code of electrician. So this is going to cover somebody more than licensed journeyman electricians. This bill goes well beyond that. This bill is not like all the other extensions which have been in place for LTV, which passed out of this committee for Ainsworth and others, which have required the training component. This has no training component to it. This bill also, the cost, because when I first saw this, I had somebody run a program as to how many people fell under this classification. 1,478 people, as of 2 weeks ago, listed this as their occupation while requesting benefits. The average weekly benefit amount, and we don't know what the average of those individuals, but the average weekly benefit amount in Minnesota currently is about $330 a week. And if this extension were to play out, the problem is that's not a fixed number, because a person may file tomorrow, next week, next month, and some of these will drop out. So, I mean, our best guess is you're talking about a cost somewhere in terms of $10 million, and we believe these additional costs to the system are inappropriate at a time that the system currently is not actuarially sound, and that's why we have problems with this particular bill. How it's drafted has a number of problems. It also uses the word permanently laid off due to lack of work, as opposed to simply seasonally or temporarily unemployed. That's always a number of problems with this bill in its current form.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Nelson and Mr. Diedrichs.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Dave Diedrichs with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber of Commerce opposes this bill for many of the same reasons as we opposed the Ainsworth bill that was before this committee a few weeks ago, and we would also like to echo some of the concerns that Mr. Nelson just expressed. Most particularly, we're concerned about the precedent that this bill could set. Certainly, there are going to be more layoffs in the future in other industries, and in the event of an economic downturn, there's the potential for a lot of people to be applying for unemployment insurance benefits extensions. And we're concerned about what type of precedent a bill like this would set in terms of when other people will look back to see whether or not they should be anticipating whether or not they'll receive these benefits. Finally, as Mr. Nelson indicated, the UI Trust Fund is currently at low levels. It's at about $320 million, which is over $1 billion below what the U.S. Department of Labor suggests, with the electricians coming forth with a $10 million benefits extension that would deplete what is already a meager resource. And finally, the Chamber believes that extending benefits should be limited to 13 weeks. This bill applies for 26, and it should only be granted if those are not available from the federal government. So accordingly, we are concerned about the precedent this bill could set. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Yes, Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is for Mr. Nelson. And Mr. Diedrichs touched on this, but could you give us just a quick overview of the current fund levels, you know, how that compares to a couple years ago? And am I right? Is my recollection right that there are trigger amounts? In other words, if it drops to a certain level, a higher tax kicks in
order
to...
Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, currently, and it's always moving, because currently we're paying out, the trust fund is paying out about $25 million a week in benefits, so it's going down as we speak. As of March 3rd, the fund had $318.6 million in it. That is a decrease from 392 on December 31st, so it is decreasing. Now, that is actually substantially higher than it has been in the past. It was in deficit status in March of 2003 by $443 million. It was in deficit. It actually has a balance as of March 3rd of $241 million over last year. So last year at this time, it had less than $100 million, and actually went into debt for about a week last year. So as Ms. Diedrichs indicated, it's currently even $1 billion short of it being actuarially sound. Now, when it does get to certain levels, automatic taxes increase. It currently is at its highest tax rates because it is. It will have to get substantially higher before there will be triggers lowering taxes. But currently, it is a long way from being anywhere near any of the triggers to actually lower taxes. Taxes were reset. There was a bill passed the legislature in 2002 changing quite a bit the whole tax structure because we knew the fund was going into debt, and so the whole tax structure was changed in 2002. But currently, they're at maximum rates under the tax statutory tax structure.
So, question that you raised, Mr. Nelson, was that you didn't know if this would stand up to a constitutional challenge under current law because of it just covering a resident of our state. Is that of a concern?
Madam Chair, it's not a constitutional challenge. The Federal Unemployment Tax Act provides that states
cannot. Mr. Fuller suggested that maybe it would be, perhaps.
States cannot impose a residency requirement on the payment of benefits. Pardon?
Under current law, if a Wisconsin resident works in Minnesota and is covered employment, can that person draw regular benefits?
Yes.
So this law is saying that if you're a resident, or this bill says if you're a resident of Wisconsin, you can't draw extended benefits. So it in a sense, discriminates against residents of Wisconsin with respect to the extended benefit.
As this bill is currently written, you could have worked in Minnesota, lived in Minnesota, start living in Minnesota while you're collecting the extension, move to Hudson, Wisconsin, and you would be cut off because you are a resident of Wisconsin. I believe that it, my reading of federal law says you cannot impose a residency requirement on the payment of benefits.
Well, Madam Chair, I think there is a constitutional dimension to that issue, that if you, that you cannot discriminate against non-residents with respect to receipt of unemployment compensation on this basis.
Madam Chair, if I might say, whether it meets constitution, it wouldn't pass. Mr. Fuller may well be correct. It's unconstitutional, but it also would not pass federal law. There's a specific federal statute which says states may not impose a residency requirement on the payment of benefits.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So thank you very much. Senator Murphy, what would you like to do with the bill?
Pass it.
Pass it? Do you want to work on anything in the bill, or? I thought I would just ask what you wanted to do with the bill.
Madam Chair, and I would move that we delete line 1.8.
Okay. There's been a motion made by Senator Murphy to delete line 1.8 and then renumber the other lines appropriately.
Okay. Madam Chairman, we need to include 1.22 in that motion as well.
And 1.12. I'm sorry, 1.22 as well, and then renumber. So the motion has been made to delete lines 1.8 and 1.22.
Madam Chair?
Yes, and look, Mr. Fuller?
Madam Chair, if you look at line 1.22, now it reads, a majority of applicants' wage credits were from employment. And so it probably needs to modify whether it's from employment as an electrician or something, because there's no subject there now.
But we're taking out...
We're taking out the whole line?
The whole line. We're taking out the whole line on 1.22? We're taking out the whole line on 1.22.
That was a suggestion from Mr.
From
Nelson.
From Mr. Nelson.
All right.
All right. Is there any other discussion on the motion to amend? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Okay. The motion passes.
And
Senator Murphy.
And, Madam Chairman, just a little rebuttal on a couple things. Mr. Dietrichs had talked about you know, people going into this craft and looking around to see who had the kind of best unemployment compensation benefits. I don't know any electricians or pipe fitters or anybody out there that goes into a craft or goes into a job, you know, with their eye on unemployment benefits. That's not why you go to work. I mean, you go to work to work. And, you know, most of the people that we're talking about here in the electricians' rank and file, you know, they were displaced because of something we did here. And I firmly believe that. If you look at the $10 million of costs that Mr. Nelson was talking about, the true cost to the state is roughly about $60 million, and about $12.5 million of that is added cost to the MNSCU system to train these people who are being trained for unemployment. You know, as far as the licensure, when Mr. Nelson talks about licensure of electricians, not all the people that work in our field are licensed electricians. We have several exemptions, and Mr. Fuller could probably pull them out of the statute book at the drop of a hat, but we have all kinds of exemptions in our utility business that allows people to be electricians and work in the field without being licensed at power plants, at substations, and some of these other installations. But they do it. They're journeymen. They go through four-year apprentice programs. But no, they're not licensed. And how to classify all of these electricians the same and say that it has to be a licensed electrician would not hit, you know, all of the people who are affected here. You know, and then Mr. Nelson also talked about, well, the exhaustion of benefits is no higher than a lot of other groups. Well, I tell you what, electricians are in demand in Colorado and California and Florida, and guess what happens? These people pull up roots and they move. And that's that loss of human capital that I talked about earlier. We're training these people. We're paying good tax dollars to get them out there and get them into the job place, and then they don't have employment, so they take their skills and they go to Florida. We don't want that. As far as employer responsibility, that is in the bill, that they, you know, the employer is still going to have to pay their freight here. Well, that's really no different than anybody else. I mean, the employer is the person who pays the tax, and you know, that's, I don't want to say that's tough, but you know, that's the way life is.
Okay.
Madam Chairman, I would move that Senate File 1806 be recommended to pass, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor.
Very good. Is there any fiscal note on this? There's, okay. Is that where it goes? To the floor?
There's one technical amendment.
And there's one technical amendment.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Fuller?
Page 2, line 13, before the word under, just say described under. Subdivision 1 to make it consistent with what was earlier in the bill.
Okay, Senator Murphy, would you move that technical amendment to add
yes,
as
I
described
would.
Under on line 213? Discussion? Yes, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? And the motion prevails. All right, we'll go back to the original motion to move Senate File 1806 to go directly to the floor. Any other discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Same sign. I'd like to take a division. I'd like to see a hand. I can't tell. Sorry. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Okay. Opposed? All right. The motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members.
Thank you. Our next is Senate File 356, Senator Linda Berglund, with window screen safety requirements. And we have about 15 minutes. I understand that many of the stakeholder groups have been working on this bill prior to coming to this committee. We'd like to have some testimony, but we'd also like to be able to move this bill out of committee today since we have a number of people here to testify. If you're comfortable with that, Senator
Madam
Berglund.
Chair, I do have a delete everything amendment. This is the first hearing for this bill.
So I think absolutely we'll pass that out.
I'll move the amendment, Madam Chair.
And Senator Tomasoni moves the...
We have an oral addition to the amendment, so...
We've got an oral addition.
Senator Berglund moves the A1 amendment on Senate File 356. Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, she's not on the committee.
Senator Tomasoni moves. I'm sorry. And when you all have a chance to see it...
Is there an oral amendment?
And an oral amendment. Would you like to...
Lines point 125, after the word data, insert... resulting in severe injury.
I'll incorporate that, Madam Chair.
And Senator Tomasoni includes resulting in severe injury on line 1.25 after data. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Berglund, welcome.
So, Madam Chair, then in the interest of brevity, we have a number of children fall out of windows and be seriously injured or killed every year, and it is completely preventable. And I had one death and one serious injury this summer in my district of small children falling out of windows. And so the purpose of this bill was to create a safer environment for our children by altering the windows. We have safe screens that can be manufactured for safer buildings. They are available today, and as the amendment indicates, they are in the rules that exist today for HUD-constructed buildings. And the other advantage of those screens is that they are much more durable, so they don't need to be replaced as frequently. Replacement of window screens in rental units is a very high cost every year to anyone who operates one of those buildings. And so the idea of this bill is to get standards into the building code that will prevent window falls from small children. And hopefully the screens will be the preferable way that people will go in regard to meeting the code in the future. The second part of the bill we've discussed with the Department of Health, and with additional oral language, they believe that this can be absorbed by their department, and it would simply be to create an educational safety program and to track injuries that occur in the state after we get the standards in place.
Thank you. Excellent work. And with you today, I believe, is Mr. Jim Graham. Are you testifying next, Mr. Graham?
Yes, ma'am.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming today.
Madam Chair, committee, I call this the Layla bill because the little girl that started or was the inception of this fell four floors through a screen and landed on concrete and lived and was not permanently injured. And the reason it's called a Layla law is that that was a miracle. And I say that you don't need a miracle to save children. All you need is responsible legislation that actually require the safety measures that would protect children. Because we should have, we should expect that children would be safe in our homes. There's a lady here today, a grandmother whose grandchild was bouncing on a bed entertaining a small child. That child was kind of catapulted into a window screen and went three floors and died. That happens over and over and over. In fact, the media and reporters have actually come and thanked me for this because they say they have huge files on these children that have gone through windows and died, and they need something to happen because they don't like reporting on those situations. And that, so that is really what the bill is about. The bill is to do what one would expect, and that's to make children safe in their homes. There is a compromise, and that compromise has been because the window companies, the building industry, the building officials, along with Commissioner Hodruff, have sat in a room and created that compromise. So everybody was in agreement, and people said, well, at least it's a feel-good thing that everybody can feel good about. Well, in my own opinion, the bill will start that, and the portion of it that says that there needs to be reports and that the commissioner needs to create those things will, I think, allow it to be put into effect and, if necessary, streamlined in the future so that it will meet the needs to protect children. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Graham, thank you. And please come to the table. And Senator Scoy.
I think this question is for Mr. Graham. I'm reading here that you're going to adopt these rules, and it's going to deal with the types, locations, and sizes of windows. Are you thinking that you would have different rules for the first floor than the fourth floor, or what are you thinking there?
I think that that would come from the commissioner, and I think that there should be different rules. But quite honestly, this actually started because I took my granddaughter and set her on a windowsill on the first floor. And my wife came by and screamed at me that my 8-pound cat runs through that window. How dare I risk that child there? 5 minutes later, I got a call that that Layla Shagabe had gone through a window. And so that is sort of there. But that is my anticipation is that the commissioner in creating those rules would, in fact, streamline that.
Thank you.
All right, we have another person at the table. And if you would introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Mike Fisher, and I am representing the Window and Door Manufacturers Association. We want to thank Senator Bergen for bringing this forward. We actually spent a lot of our efforts working on window safety. When the bill first came out, we had major concerns with it, but we've worked, I would say, very hard. I've been spending a lot of time in the Twin Cities in the last few weeks, and I believe we've come with a great compromise. And I would say that we've had discussions within our industry group of taking this program that we're trying to put in place here forward and use it as a model in some other states that need some attention to this. We've combined elements that include the opportunity for contractors and occupants to use screens that are designed to resist impact, other types of hardware devices, and things that will meet the national standards. And we're also including what's very important is the data gathering and educational component. I had planned to make longer notes, but in the interest of time and so on. I will simply stand back. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But we again, appreciate the compromise, and we certainly support the as amended. Thank you.
Are there other questions, Senator Day? Oh, I thought I saw your hand up.
Madam Chair, you can't legislate stupidity. And there will be windows that will be open, and there will be kids that fall out. And I guess we'll all feel better today that we're trying to regulate stuff, and I can't handle too much more, but we only got a few more weeks to go, so.
Other questions? Comments?
I'll move the bill as amended, Madam Chair.
All right. Senator Tomasoni moves the bill as amended. Is there any other discussion? Again, I just want to thank everyone for working ahead of time. As you've seen today, we've sent some people out in the hallway, and it's nice not to have to send anyone out in the hallway to work on a bill. So thanks for doing all that work ahead of time. With that, all those in favor of Senate File 356 as amended, please say aye.
Madam Chair.
Aye. And excuse me?
Madam Chair, is it going to local government?
I believe it goes straight to the floor.
About rulemaking.
All right. Then it goes to local government. All right. All those in favor of Senate File 356, which will be going to the local government, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign?
No.
Motion passes.
Thank you.
We will not have time for Senator Carlson's bill unless you think you can do it really, really quickly, Senator.